just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm librarian, I'm a librarian, and I like it quiet so the pages can be burned. I'm a librarian, I'm a librarian, and I do it for the love of the word.
Well, I hope by now you've gotten the idea that you are listening to the Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio right here in Sitka, Alaska. And on the Library Show, we like to talk about books and ideas and writing. And so I have invited a very special man, because I don't know that people know how funny he is and that he's also a wonderful writer. And that his name is Kent Hansen. So welcome to the Library Show.
I'm here.
You are here.
I'm stunned that you said I'm funny and all that sort of stuff. Well, we'll see about that.
You make me laugh.
Yeah.
So to let you know what the framework of the show is today, Kent is going to share a story that he wrote. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the history is sort of that you wrote stories to entertain your children?
My grandchildren.
Okay, your grandchildren. Yeah.
And
right.
My children.
Okay.
Course.
So why don't we get started and you frame the story or do whatever you need to do?
Well, I can do that easily here. It's the story title is called The Spree at Ruthless Ruth's Confectionery.
That sounds good already.
And I'll launch into it right now.
Okay, yeah, sounds okay. Good.
Jake's father put us to work splitting and piling firewood. He promised a dollar for each split and stacked cord. We had a vision of making a vast fortune in the firewood splitting and piling. Certainly, we could make enough for a few traps, some BB gun ammunition, and a bottle or two of pop. After all, a dollar was the daily wage in 1939. Hard maple by the cord must weigh several tons. The volume of such a quantity of wet wood is 4 feet by 4 feet by 8 feet, or roughly 128 cubic feet. The problem in making this amount of firewood was not in the lugging needed to attack the cord. It was in the splitting. Imagine two small boys armed with axes, wedges, mauls, and, of course, enthusiasm, working for what seemed forever to make a cordwood pile. It was a mite less than 1 month when we finished. Jake and I split, cussed, and lugged every night after school on Saturday and on Saturdays until a cord was complete. I had wanted to quit after the first afternoon, but Jake outraged my manhood by taunts, panty waist, mollycoddle, sissy. Such epithets are wonderful stuff, the finest kind of peer psychology. I worked through the duration, silently suffing the indenture of pride. Jake's father paid $1.02. He inspected our pile, said good, reached into his pocket and handed Jake a fistful of change. The 22-cent difference between the promised dollar and cord and the actual pocket change Jake's father didn't care to count out. Don't spend it all on a spree now, he said. Jake's father walked away grinning. We tallied the change, 2 quarters, 5 dimes, 4 nickels, and 2 pennies. The disparity between the bulk of our woodpile and the cash in hand disturbed my ripening economic sensibilities. I avoided this kind of contract since. Jake, however, was delighted. He decided we would buy 2 traps at 25 cents each and 4 packs of BB ammunition at 15 cents. The rest would be for our spree. Ruthless Ruth's Confectionery was the only pop and candy store in our neighborhood. Spinster Ruth held this exclusive territory since her wealthy brother had provided the investment capital for the purchase of the store. Ruth was old, crabby, and ruthless. She could, however, be delightful when the situation warranted. She smiled pleasantly when Jake appeared at her counter with a clenched right hand. Two cherry pops and a couple packages of Twinkies, ordered Jake. He counted out the exact change on the countertop, 15 cents. While we swilled from the pop bottles and gulped cream-filled rolls, Ruth watched. As we finished, she reached behind the counter and produced two brown, bloated gut busters, leftover chocolate eclairs. These she wrapped in wax paper and handed to us. Old Ruthless was not known for her charity. Thankful, Jake bought two more pops, this time Ritbeer. We flushed the stale thickness of the ancient eclairs down with liberal gulps of Ritbeer. We finished the eclairs. I ordered a chocolate soda, 10 cents. Jake thought that this a fine idea and ordered one for himself. We drained these and ordered another round. Then the second round was finished. I determined it was time to leave. Jake stifled a belch and agreed. Ruth menaced as we moved toward the door. She reached into the glass case under the candy counter and produced a handful of jawbreakers. It was another one on the house. This was truly an event. Jake showed our appreciation by buying a dozen more jawbreakers and a mess of gumdrops and some chocolates. The candies were quickly finished off in the alley behind Herb's pool hall. Just down the block from Ruth's place. Then Jake puked first. I watched, heard, and was instantly ill. We retched miserably, emitting a chorus of counterpunctual barfs and glurps, which echoed through the canyon of the alley. The waves of nausea slowly passed. Following the eruption, we rested. Jake's eyes still watered as he stood and checked the remaining cash in his hand. 47, said Jake. Enough for two more rounds of soda and candy. We staggered down the alley toward Ruth's. And I guess I read the title on that, but that was called
The Spree.
The Spree at Ruthless Ruth's Confectionery.
Now, is any of this based in actual experience as a kid?
Yeah, we were 7 years old at the time.
Oh, my gosh. And did you actually end up getting the traps and the ammo as well?
No, we didn't do that. We'd spend it all on the spree.
That's a great story. And I love the wonderful little insults that were showered upon you at the very beginning.
Pantyways. That was a common one in those days.
Well, that's a good one. Well, let's get to what do you have in your book bag? We've got plenty of time to talk books, too.
Okay, well, you had one to go to.
Well, no, I want to hear what's in your book bag.
Well, I'm going to preface this first book by reading a short poem that I wrote.
Okay, perfect.
And I think I've got it here.
So have you been writing for a long time?
Yeah, I had two periods of writing. I taught English over at Mount Edgecombe for about 4 or 5 years, and then because I required the kids to write,
you better write,
I had
too.
Better write something, too. And so that was what happened there. But then I also, this other stuff I also did there. But I'm going to bring out a book about, the title is Mind and the Rob and the Raven. Mind and the Raven is by Baron Heinrich. And he is a professor at the University of Vermont. And he was an entomologist and an ecologist. Yeah, he was an entomologist and ecologist, but then he kind of launched into animal psychology, and he was fascinated by ravens, and he studied these in the north woods of Maine. He studied these in Alaska. He was in Sitka. But what I liked about the book is his design of his experiments, and they were very, very good. But anyway, the poem I'm going to read is one that I wrote following there. When I worked over at Mount Edgecombe, there was a roof right across from our place, and every morning there was a raven would sit there, and he'd look at me through the window, and I'd look at him. And then one day it snowed, and he was up there, and it was just white all over, and he was sitting there, and I was inspired to write this poem. And I call it Another Consciousness. A raven pressed against the universal whiteness, aloft in the invisible sphere of silent, solemn winter. Head cant, a canny eye fixed in our mutual gaze, riveted, piercing those clear limits of ice and air and mind, especially mind. So,
well, can you tell me, were there any things in the book that kind of surprised you about ravens that you maybe didn't know? Or
no, but he cataloged in this book the behavioral characteristics he noted of the ravens, including the calls and all this sort of things. And one of the things was very interesting, that these populations of ravens have different characteristics depending on where they are. Like an urban raven, like a Sitka raven, would have different calls and more variety of calls and behavioral characteristics than a raven that you would find out in the wilderness, for example. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember that the Sitka High School had a problem because, as you know, they built a flat-roofed building, and it was covered with a black membrane. And the ravens would go, for whatever reason, and pick at that membrane in different places, and then, of course, created leaks and so forth. But that's not a behavior that was anywhere else in Southeast that they knew of.
I don't know. I never heard him say anything like that. But they peck, among other things, to just display to the other ravens that they are a dominant critter or whatever. But I noticed this around Sitka, that the ravens in the where I would go hunting, you know, they had a different calls, postures, and everything else. And I can remember going up deer hunting and shooting a deer and going over and gutting it out and then leaving it on the hillside there where we went on to hunt some other place, and then going up on the hill and looking down, and all at once all these crows would come down. And then after the crows would start pecking around at the guts and everything, then the ravens would come down there. And finally the eagles would come. It's sort of like the Serengeti Plains. Mm-hmm. And he describes this behavior of the different birds coming around as far north as Barrow, for example. He worked up there. In Sitka, he didn't have much to say about the ravens here, other than to say that the vocalizations of the birds here in Sitka are much greater than they are in other places where he studied.
Oh, interesting.
Ravens. Yeah.
I just noticed yesterday when I was walking that there were two ravens that were tightly clenched and spinning as they went down and then broke free.
Yeah, they do that, and they also fly along, and then they do a roll over, and they go click, click like that, and then they keep flying. He describes that in this book. But anyway, the book is Mind of the Raven.
Okay.
And he gives a lot of experiments where he indicated they had intelligence and extreme learning. They he did a lot with the vocalizations of them. And the different raven individuals have different voices and different calls that they used characteristically. So that was
Sounds like a good read, and something that most Sitkins would probably be interested in.
Yeah.
And you made a remark that I thought was interesting. You walk a lot.
Yeah.
And so after having read this book, you kind of became more alert at what you were seeing
well,
around
Well, I was
you.
Able to interpret what I saw and what I heard.
Right.
Yeah, for example, right down here by the boat in Crescent Harbor here, there's two ravens that always sit there every morning, and Rod Nutting and I always walk there, and when they see us coming, they go, gluck, gluck, gluck. Click, 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 and I go click, click, click back at them. And so anyway,
a relationship.
Yeah. So we have all the raven pairs all spotted along our trip hike here. But anyway, the book is by Bernd Heinrich, and they have it at the library. It's called Mind of the Raven.
Okay, sounds good. So what else do you have in your book bag?
Well, I got a book here by a husband and wife team called Palumbi. I think that's the way you spell it. Palumbi and Palumbi. It's called Extreme Life of the Sea. And it covers a lot of the recent research on the life within the oceans around the world. And they've discovered so many more species and that type of thing. And they filled in all the gaps in the life cycles of all these critters. But I know in the Pacific around this area, they did some surveys on the bacteria in the ocean. And when I was taking, you know, invertebrate anatomy and stuff like that, they never even considered what bacteria lived in the oceans. But I think in the Sitka area and up through Alaska, they found over 300 new species of bacteria, which are photosynthetic. Wow. And that forms a new base for the food web, because normally you know, when I went to school, it was the plankton, it was the diatoms and the amphipods and a few of those small organisms that were the drifters in the ocean. They formed the base of the food bed, but now they've discovered that it's all these photosynthetic bacteria and even viruses in the ocean.
So are they microscopic then?
They're very much microscopic, okay. Yeah.
Well, I remember, or would they be considered harmful, beneficial?
Well, they'd be beneficial. And
okay.
It's believed that that the first photosynthetic creatures were bacteria. And they were absorbed into the other things that fed on them, and then they became the planktonic animals like diatoms and some of those things, the larger critters, you know.
Right. And viruses as well. I interrupted
well,
you.
Viruses would be that at the very bottom. They would be the decomposers of the bacteria. When the bacteria die and break down, then the viruses would either kill them or they would feed off the residual from that. So
what the title is, the extreme forms, was that extreme?
They would go right down to the bottom in the deepest parts of the ocean. Okay. And they found an abundance of life all over through that, of various sizes and kinds and phyla and so forth. But anyway, it's called The Extreme Life of the Sea. I think you can get it at the library, but I've got a copy of my own.
Okay. It's not a huge book. Was it a readable book, or was it highly scientific?
It was very readable, particularly if you've had any kind of a – well, it's readable on two levels. It's readable on a level of if you've had some scientific knowledge of biology mainly, and chemistry. There's a lot of chemistry there. But on the level of just – anybody that doesn't have a strict background in that, it would be still a good read, because it has some fantastic, and it has a lot of good pictures. But what amazes me about these books is the glossary and
the documentation,
and each chapter has a incredible. I'm just the notes, I guess
right.
They call them, and it's chapter by chapter notes. And it brings in the history of the study, which is interesting in itself, but they also bring in a lot of new stuff that would fascinate anybody that's at all interested in
the ocean. So give us that title and authors again.
Yeah, the authors are Palumbi, that's P-A-L-U-M-B-I, Palumbi and Palumbi, that's a husband and a wife team,
okay.
And it's The Extreme Life of the Sea.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
especially since it's not 600 pages. Yeah. Although if you looked at all the notes, there's probably extensive
extra
reading.
Well, the notes are
reading.
Extensive, but I think it runs but just a little over 200 with the notes.
Okay. And I know there's another book in your book bag.
I got another one here. It's called The Sixth Extinction.
Okay.
And this is...
And who is it by?
It's by Elizabeth Colbert, or Colbert.
Okay.
And she's a writer for the, I think it's National Geographic is one of the things. Okay. But she covers the geological periods, and there's been five extinctions so far. And we, according to this book, and she documents everything in there, and it has to do with global warming and all that stuff. And
So by five extinctions, what do you mean?
Where 90% of the organisms disappeared. And the last one was during the Jurassic, and that was when that meteor hit the Earth.
And is that pretty conclusive?
That's where they keep getting more and more evidence of that, and that's when the dinosaurs all disappeared in the Jurassic period.
Okay.
And the only thing that was left, even in the oceans, a large number, 80% or 90% of the species died off. They had a global winter at that time, for a couple of years. No light could get through there.
Okay.
So a lot of critters died in that. But she starts way back at the beginning in the first geological extinction period and goes right through the Devonian and the Centrozoic and so forth. But there's been five massive extinctions where up to 90% of all the creatures living on Earth disappeared suddenly.
Then let me ask you a question. Did it tend to be because the climate got colder or because it got warmer?
It's because of volcanic activity, clouding over. It's because of global warming and ice age stuff. So
both.
Yeah. So I'm not going to get into that too much, but anyway, this is a
that is right from the
Pulitzer
library.
Prize winning book. Yeah.
And that's interesting because I never thought of there being five and potentially a sixth mass extinction.
Yeah. So I'm going to cover just a little bit on the last extinction that's coming, that's going on right now. She discusses this thing with amphibians. They're all disappearing.
It's hard to listen
to. Large mammals,
Right.
And they're the first one that usually goes. And one of the chapters is on birds, the thing with feathers, it's called. And... this is it.
Okay.
We're right into the period of the third extinction. And you can, it'd be hard to argue against what she comes up with because the research is becoming more and more, the conclusions on the research.
It would seem that many of the predictions are becoming what is happening. Well, on a much lighter note, I am going to just mention a book by Bill Bryson. And it's called The Road to Little Dribbling, Adventures of an American in Britain. And many people will have read one or two things by him, but he did write Walk in the Woods, which is a very funny account, I should say. He's not a travel writer in the traditional sense. I would call him, he writes about journeys. So he had, he put the call out to many friends to see if they would hike with him along the Appalachian Trail. And only one guy responded and he was a hopeless case. But while he is American, he is married to a British woman and he did, get British citizenship. And one of his early books, he writes about exploring England. And this, publisher said, well, why don't you go back and look at England again 20, 30, 40 years later? And he decides not to follow the original route, but he does cover a lot of England. And he finds great delight, but he also finds a certain amount of kind of I don't want to say stupidity, but maybe ignorance. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd just read a little passage to give people a flavor of what his writing is like. This is from early on in the book. My time in Britain describes a kind of bell curve, starting at the bottom left-hand corner in the knows almost nothing at all, and rising in a gradual arc to pretty thorough acquaintanceship at the top. Having attained this summit, I assumed that I would remain there permanently. But recently, I've begun to slide down on the other side toward ignorance and bewilderment again, as increasingly I find myself living in a country that I don't altogether recognize. It is a place full of celebrities whose names I don't know and talents I cannot discern, of acronyms BFF, TMI, TOWIE, that have to be explained to me, of people who seem to be experiencing a different kind of reality from the one I know. I'm constantly at a loss in this new world. Recently, I closed my door on a caller because I couldn't think of what else to do with him. He was a meter reader. At first, I was pleased to see him. We haven't had a meter reader at our house since Edward Heath was Prime Minister, so I let him in gladly and even fetched a stepladder so that he could climb up and get a clear reading. It was only when he departed and returned a minute later that I began to regret our deepening relationship. Sorry, I also need to read the meter in the men's room, he told me. I beg your pardon. Well, it says here that there's a second meter in the men's room. Well, we don't have a men's room because this is a house, you see. Well, it says here it's a school. Well, it's not. It's a house. You were just in it. Did you see some roomfuls of young people? He thought hard for a minute. Do you mind if I have a look around? I beg your pardon. Well, just a little look. Won't take 5 minutes. You think you're going to find a men's room that we have somehow overlooked? Well, you never know, he said brightly. I'm shutting the door now because I don't know what else to do, I said, and shut the door. And so that's just kind of a little sample of... And there are many parts of England that are beautiful, and there's a lot of hiking and walking. And you have been to England.
Right. Yes, I have.
And they really do, even in agricultural areas, you'll usually find walking paths, and they have these wonderful, I can't think, it's in the Ordnance Survey maps that you can pick up that really detail every little bit of land, which, of course, has been trodden on for centuries. So different, very different than Alaska, because it's a place that has layer upon layer upon layer of history.
Yeah.
And... So I would recommend just about anything from Bill Bright. And I love the Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, which is his growing up. And I had picked that up when I was visiting in Wales, of all things. And just it was just really kind of a laugh out loud book. But so that's kind of my contribution. And as well, they've made a movie of his, A Walk in the Woods. But I would recommend reading his book above watching the movie, as it's not a good substitute. Well, we are fast getting to the end of our show with Kent Hansen. Can we quickly review your books?
Yeah, I would like to add to that book, Sixth Extinction. I noticed this quite a while ago when I was a kid, and one of the stories I can read at some time later. Okay. Is called The Harvest, and it's about frog hunting.
Okay.
And I've returned to my homeland quite a few times, and the frogs are disappearing.
I know.
And so this is kind of, you know, becoming an interesting book for me, because she does have a chapter on amphibians.
Well, thanks for coming, Kent. You've been listening to The Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio.